was young, Lowell and I decided that at some point we would be interested in serving in the medical field in undeveloped countries. And we were all set to go to Tanzania when they opened a new hospital near Kilimanjaro when our kids were in school. And however, just before we were to make our final arrangements, my office partner decided to move to California, which would mean there'd be no place for my practice. So that was scrapped, and we then waited until our kids were no longer, quote, needed, unquote, us as much. And that particular point in time became blurred, as a matter of fact, because as soon as some were gone, then some others started coming back. So instead of retiring at age 58 like I had planned, I did retire at age 62. And Lola, who's a nurse practitioner, and I went to American Samoa. We kind of thought that would be a good place to start. It had a nice ring to it, American Samoa. And their medical care is all taken care of by the government there. There's a 170-bed hospital.
LBJ Tropical Medical Center.
And all the clinics are operated from the hospital. And we got there, and we got a nice apartment right on the hospital grounds. It was, you know, sort of third class, but adequate in that climate. She had mentioned that the temperature is between, you know, 86 and 90 all the time, which doesn't sound very bad, but it's 100% humidity, and it was the most uncomfortable place we worked. Even more uncomfortable than 130 degrees in Pakistan. But the we had to contend with other inhabitants of our nice apartment. The gecko population was impressive, and we had the cockroaches that ate Cincinnati to live with.
Three of them would make a meal.
Right? Oh yes, oh, yes.
Also, the weather was different than what we're accustomed to in the Northwest, where our rain is a little drizzle, and most of our friends don't even own raincoats. There, you can hear the rain coming. These leaves are very large, and the raindrops are so fierce, it sounds like a roar of an express train coming, and you kind of figure you haven't got time to run across the road and get to the apartment before, you know, the wave of rain hits. The raindrops were bigger. And I always wondered why they had, where the valleys and the roofs are, they had a great big tub about four times as big as this wooden, this rock thing here. Looked like a massive Japanese bathtub, because in a few minutes the rain would collect all this and it would pour off in a stream about twice the amount that comes out of the mine portal into this thing and fill it up in a few minutes, mm-hmm. and keep from washing the lawn away. Anyway, the it was the most frustrating place that we've worked, because the hospital had all of the amenities except that they weren't maintained. So you had high hopes that you could get blood gases for the newborns that were in respiratory distress and so on, and they'd be out of reagents. Or you'd have a child with a meningitis and order the IV antibiotic, and they'd say, sorry, we're out. And I said, well, I told you they were low 3 months ago. And well, the legislature spent the money someplace else, and so the company hasn't been paid and have canceled all orders in the United States. So it was an uncomfortable place to work from that standpoint. And this looks like paradise here in the pictures. But medically, it was anything but. There was no malaria there, but there was a tremendous amount of infection. Every child, even the American kids, had scars and abscesses all over their legs. Skin infections were rampant. Some of the abscesses would be so big when you're ready to get a quart of pus out.
That's
a
wonderful thought after dinner.
Yes.
Why not the malaria?
No,
they don't have the right, they don't have the wrong mosquito.
They don't have any anopheles mosquitoes.
Okay.
Oh.
Yeah. The other thing was, I'd see sometimes 40 patients a day, and half of them would be pneumonia. You think of pneumonia in cold weather and so on, but the infection rate is horrible there. Newborns, an extraordinary high percentage of them had respiratory distress. And we couldn't figure it out why that was so. But we suspected it's because they have some traditional medicine features that require violent massage of the pregnant lady's belly. Mm. And we think that what happens is it produced a passage of meconium, the baby's bowel movement. And so then when the baby is in the process of being born, it aspirates this stuff, which coats the lungs and gives them so much trouble. So there was a lot of features that were a lot more unhealthy to live than what we were. Now Lola, worked 10 miles or so away in a clinic. She had a whole staff there that she operated, her own little domain. And they saw even more patients than we did in the clinic because they worked the clinic all day. We only worked half day, the other half on the wards. But it was interesting to learn their culture. It was interesting to make friends and be guests in their homes. Their homes, as you can see, are nothing but roofs and floors, for the most part. And our apartment had walls on two ends, and the other two walls, the larger ones, were nothing but louvered glass. So you could change the louvers and close them in the rainstorm, but otherwise, you try to capture every bit of breeze you possibly could. So we worked there for 6 months.
6 long months.
However, we did get a 2-week vacation and we went to New Zealand and hiked the Milford Track.
I had a good
day. Had a wonderful time there, hiked in the rain.
One of the things about Samoa that was very interesting to us, it has a very strong family system and they are formed essentially into clans, and there's a head man in each clan and they have common land that belongs to the family, and they have names for all of these things. But it was very interesting to learn about their culture. It's very different than ours, and they do, you know, they are a territory of the United States. So lawyers from the United States go over to serve as the judges there, and they have to learn all of the what's the name of the
pitfalls?
Well, no, but the name of the group. The Iinga is the family, so it's Iinga law, and they have to learn that law and apply that. I think that's enough of the soap opera. Right. Thank you. Is the slide we took out?
No, it's
okay. They have to go to operate on both those systems, so it's really a trick for any of the government lawyers in the United States to go over there and try and deal with the American Samoan court cases, and almost all of them involve land. Land is the big issue. And one thing you might be interested to know is that there are more Samoans in California than there are in Samoa.
What is that?
They want to emigrate. That's the thing that they really are interested in doing. And a lot of them join the service if they can't get into the football.
Yeah, a lot of them are football players.
To be able to get to the United States. Mm-hmm. Okay, our next place that we went was to Zimbabwe.
We should tell about the singing.
Well, you heard the singing. In a climate like this, an organ falls apart, a piano falls apart, and so what you have are you have voices. And you have four-part harmony all the time. Going to church in American Samoa is just, oh, it's wonderful. And it's the same thing in actually in Africa. And I don't know if Tom's here or not, but he can, I'm sure, speak to that as well in South Africa. And the African music that you hear comes always in four parts. And it's just beautiful. And they come in singing these things. And in the American Samoan churches, of which there are a lot, the women all wear white. They wear white, I wish I could remember the name of all the things that we wore. I've been in several cultures now. So, no, it's not called a mumu, it's got another name. But they're all dressed in white. The men are all dressed in black. The women sit on the left side of the church and the men sit on the right side. And they have antiphonal singing going back and forth. And it is absolutely wonderful. It's really quite special. Well, the next place we went was to Zimbabwe, which you may remember was called Rhodesia up until 1980. We were there in 1987. And so it was only 7 years after their War of Independence. The black area there is Zimbabwe. We were up in the right-hand top corner, right near the border of Mozambique. Mozambique was having its war while we were there. The lower part, of course, is all South Africa. And this was probably, do we do it this way?
You don't have to do that.
Works. Great, okay. We had kind of an interesting situation when we got to Zimbabwe, to Harare, which is the name of the capital. It used to have another name. It was called something else.
Rhodesia.
Yeah, but the capital had another English name. Harare had been the original name. And when we arrived, we had been hired essentially by the United Methodist Church, which meant that they paid for our tickets. And we got there, and it turned out that the bishop, who had been an American, an interim bishop, who hired us, had gone back to the United States, and his secretary was on vacation in Banff. And no one knew where our papers were. And you have to have papers in a new country before they'll allow you to work. In fact, they want your original licenses, which they want to keep, which we were a little reluctant to give up. And so we were left with 2 weeks trying to figure out where these papers were, because they had been sent back to the United States. So we had this little typical kind of thing you have when you work overseas going on. So we had 2 weeks to sort of wander around and see the country. So this is the Sheraton Hotel in Harare, and this is a Salvation Army on a downtown street. Harare is a very cosmopolitan city. It's very large, really quite beautiful. But the problem that Zimbabwe was having at this time was economic. They had no cash flow in terms of their country. They couldn't buy things abroad because they had no cash, and it was a very difficult situation. After we left Harare, we went out to a place called Nyadiri, and that is where we worked for the next 3 months. And this is the typical mode of transportation in Africa. And of course, the wealth of a man is determined by how many animals he has, how many cows. This is the Nyadiri campus. This is the hospital. And that's the United Methodist, and we see that on United Methodist churches throughout the United States. It was a very kind of welcome thing for us to see. The countryside in Zimbabwe is really quite beautiful. There's a lot of trees. It wasn't just open. And a lot of beautiful birds and a lot of beautiful flowers. So it was really quite nice.
And mountains.
An interesting thing happened in Zimbabwe before it became independent. The churches were very, very strong, and probably one of the best mission efforts that has been done in Africa, in our mind, was done in Zimbabwe. They took the best and the brightest of the young people and sent them to either the United States or to England for their schooling, for their college. These two adults, the woman got her nursing degree in Washington, D.C., the man got his Bachelor of Arts degree outside of Washington, both in Washington colleges. Now, one of the things that was so incongruous to us was they were shaking off the imperialism of England. However, the thing that was the most important thing for them, for this family in the world, was to send their boys to typical English boarding schools. The three boys in the Blazers went to school, boarding school, in Harare, and we were about 70 miles from Harare.
Took a couple hours driving.
So there was this kind of dichotomy going on all the time about what they wanted out of their lives, and yet not yet getting rid of the English influence. This was the church. You can tell it was a little warm, but not unbearable there. And in this church, the choir came in singing. And it was, oh, I wish you could hear it. It's just really exquisite.
They had adult choir and a children's choir.
We didn't understand a word of the sermon. We tried to stay away. Phil tried to stay away. Didn't do too well, but we did our best.
But we should say that there's a whole campus. It's not just a hospital, but they have elementary school, a secondary school, a nursing school, a teacher's college, and the hospital, all on the same campus and all operated. The family that you saw portrayed there, the man is the administrator of the whole thing.
And she's the director, the nursing director of the hospital. The students who came, and they had a lot of boarding students because they covered, this was a very rural area, they covered a very large area. The students would pay $30 a month for their high school and their college program. Now that was an awful lot of money for most of them. They really didn't have money. The people themselves were very, very poor. The thing we're looking at here is a little bit of biology. This is an anthill.
Oh. One of the smaller ones.
And this is sitting out, I had a different hairdo in those days, this is sitting outside of our apartment where I would sit and do my needlepoint in the morning before I went off to the bush. Phil worked in the hospital, and I worked part-time in the hospital and part-time in the bush. And I much preferred working in the bush to working in the hospital. I'm not a hospital worker. This is the newborn ward, and the women would come to the hospital to have their babies, which meant that their live birth rate is very high. We had two physicians besides ourselves. They were a surgeon and a family practice physician, both from Germany. Germany has a very interesting situation right now, and this continues today. Anyone can go to medical school if they can pass the exam. However, when they graduate from medical school, they are not guaranteed a place to practice. So they have a surplus of physicians, both in Germany and in Scandinavia. Mm-hmm. And in Germany, the government will pay their retirement and their health insurance if they will work overseas. So there are a lot of German and Scandinavian physicians working in all the developing countries. We also had an absolutely fantastic Dutch midwife who probably has done more for that particular area of the country than anyone I know. She had trained, by the time she left just after we did, she had trained 160 nurse midwives. Mm-hmm. And these women were able to handle everything. Now the other thing about having a surgeon there was that he was able to do cesarean sections on the difficult pregnancies. And so the live birth rate was wonderful, and you can see these absolutely healthy babies. And here's Phil working in the pediatric ward. Now during the daytime, the babies are in cribs, or the children are in cribs, but at nighttime, those cribs go out in the hall and the moms and the babies sleep on a blanket on the floor. And the moms are there with the children the whole time. This is one of our favorite student nurses. You can see she's in her last year. She has her third stripe. Those of us who trained a while ago remember about the nurses, you got a different stripe each year. Some of us never got those. The children's names were quite wonderful, and I wish I could remember all of them, but one of the ones, they had lots of very long names like Maximilian, but then they would have names like Nevermore. I think they were hoping maybe that was the last child in the family. This was a young man who lives here at Nigeria. He has cerebral palsy. He's died now, but he was about 15 at that time. And 19. 19? Okay. You wouldn't have believed the care and love that this child got in this wonderful, wonderful hospital. Now, the hospital didn't have a lot of equipment. It didn't have a lot of services. The laboratory was very barren. The pharmacy was practically non-existent. But the care was excellent. I think that's never more.
That's never more.
He was kind of a favorite of ours. He was such a cute little guy. Now, this is the maternity wing, and inhabited only by women. And this is one of the student nurses giving a class in child care, in immunizations, and how to take care of your baby. And this is something that they are required to do. And here's some of the moms waiting at the Nutrition Village. Now, we don't have a pointer to show you, but if you count down 1, 2, 3, 4 babies, see that little baby sitting on the mom's, at the front part of the mom's lap? If you could really see that child, the child's hair is red, which means that the child is now malnourished. Even though they look as healthy as can be, they're not getting enough iron in their diet. And so protein, which gives us the iron. And that would give, the woman at the end is one of the teachers in the Nutrition Village, and children who are malnourished come in for instruction, and they will often stay there for 2 weeks or so.
Not only are they instructed how to feed their baby, they're instructed how to raise the crops that are important, rather than just giving them maize, which is their standard food.
Now, the tall woman here in the stripe, that's Annika. She was the nurse midwife from the Netherlands. And this is a going home with your new baby dance. They have a dance for every occasion. And the songs that Tom plays, that we are singing a lot of since he's been here, a lot of these are the same kinds of songs that you'll find in Zimbabwe that are just, they're so full of joy. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful thing. And it's a special dance that you do. It's a special going home with the new baby dance. This is the nurse midwife class that Annika finished just before she left. Wonderful women, very well trained. And this is the waiting building where the mothers, and sometimes their mothers or their sisters, come, and they bring their pot and their food, and this is where they stay until the babies are born.
This is the Nutrition Village.
It wasn't used quite as much. Now, I went out to the bush probably 4 days a week. And we went out to do well child care and immunizations and anything else that needed doing in a very crude Land Rover that we sat on milk carton boxes. There was nothing very comfortable about the whole thing. And this is the baby of one of our nurses that was with the team. These are some of the children that we saw out in the clinic. And this is an interesting woman. She is a Swedish-speaking Finnish woman. And she has been at Nideri. She had been at Nideri for 15 years at that point. She's the one who is in charge of the bush team. And she has adopted the little girl. Which one's hers?
The taller one.
No.
And then the one with the red and blue.
Well, she has adopted a little girl who speaks
Swahili.
Anyway, she speaks the African language and Swedish, because Ruth is Swedish speaking. And she says she's probably the only, this little girl says, I'm the only black Swedish speaking something or another in this country. And she probably is. Now, the little girl is standing down there by Phil, he was in one of his beard phases, is another example of malnutrition. Can you see the child's hair and the fact that it doesn't have much hair? That's protein deficiency.
Thin limbs and pot belly because of enlarged liver.
Sometimes kwashiorkor is probably a word that you've all heard. That's a very severe form. This is our bush bus. And was somewhat maintained by the man on the left, but sometimes he wouldn't maintain it too well, because if it really got to be too bad, then he could buy it from the mission and they'd have to get a new one. You run into this everywhere. Underneath a banyan tree, we would set up our clinic and hang up a scale. First of all, we would have a song, and it would be a rousing song. We'd have a prayer, and then we would begin. And the children and mothers would line up. They would have walked maybe as far as 5 miles to get there. They're very concerned about their children. They want to make sure that they have every advantage possible. Mm-hmm. As you can see, they have very, we were there in a period of drought, which has continued actually in Zimbabwe. And that's a big problem for them because the agriculture is their main economic force. But
I'd like to point out that although those clothes may be tattered, they were clean.
And this colorful fellow with the wig on decided he ought to come in and see if anybody would buy his monkey. None of us wanted his monkey. And this is the woman who would lead, she would lead the singing, and then she would do a little educational program. This was a sister hospital to ours. At the time that we went to Zimbabwe, another physician, American physician, arrived who had trained at Duke and was doing a three-year mission program at the sister hospital. This particular, the Methodist Church has three hospitals in that area. And so we went to visit him. And this was an orphanage. Now this is a very unusual thing for Zimbabwe because they don't give up their children. But they are, at that point, were going through a very profound cultural change in that the men were having to go into the city to get work, leaving women at home with the family. However, the men would often take a mistress or another wife in the city. And the result was, for the first time in their history, orphanages. So they were trying to place these children. They were wonderful children. But see that pot belly? Mm-hmm. That's another case of not enough protein in the diet.
Were there children in the orphanage because of AIDS in the family?
No, AIDS had just started.
Okay.
AIDS had just started in Africa at that time. So we can't really speak to what's happened since that. But most of the children, of course, are dying.
We never saw a case of AIDS the whole time we were there.
There was one.
Now it's rampant.
Yeah. Throughout.
Yeah.
And you can pick that up on the television. The country of Zimbabwe is made up of two different tribes. And you know, when Africa was divided up into countries, it wasn't the Africans who did it, it was the Europeans and the Americans. And so they put these two tribes together who don't necessarily get along. And one is the Netabeli, and this is the this is a kind of a place you can go and see what the culture was like and what the houses were like. This is a Netabeli village. And you can see the pictures on the walls. That's very common. This is Victoria Falls. We had, in this time, this 2 weeks we had, we did get to see a little bit of, it's really quite beautiful. We didn't, we saw the statue of Livingston, I suppose.
You presume?
Presume, thank you. This is the one of the kind of the bonuses of working in overseas countries is we tend to like a lot of anthropology and archaeology. And this is old Zimbabwe. No one knows how old it is, except that they found things there from Portuguese traders from the year, I think it was 1100. And it's made all out of bricks or stones, essentially, that are put together without any concrete or any kind of mortar. And it's it was a lot of fun to see. The other thing that you find, I don't know if you can see them too well, but they're the rock paintings on the back there. I think, is there another slide? Sorry about that.
Many are, you know, 3,000, 5,000 years old.
And then we have a little bit of the flora and fauna. This is more of the whatever. And he had a very nice roar. Tom, why don't you come on in and watch the pictures?
It was taken through the closed window in the car.
They have, one of the things that the English did when they lived there was, of course, they all had lots and lots and lots of servants to work for them. So there were several absolutely fantastic gardens that had been developed in the country. And this is some of the, this is one of the gardens that we went to, which has now been made into a national park. This is hibiscus, growing wild, cannas, and it was a water lily pond. The other thing that happened in Zimbabwe, and this happened during the time when there were, the embargo was on Rhodesia as it was going through the war, and there was a farm and a Catholic mission that were close to each other. The farmer could not, he had a lot of black slaves, not slaves, but black people working for him for a very wages. And he didn't have any way to keep his people busy. At the Catholic mission, there was a priest who was also a sculptor. And the sculptor taught the black people how to carve. And Zimbabwe now has more world-known sculptors than any other country in the world. And this is just one sculpture garden that we went to. Now, this is, these things are sort of crude. The ones that were that we really loved were the ones that were indoors in Harare. Okay. Zimbabwe was a very satisfying place for us to work. We really felt as if we were very welcome there. It was, we never had any qualms about our safety. It was also, you felt like it was really good work that you were doing. And then when we were ready to leave, the new young physician from Germany had arrived, and we were filling in till he got there. And so we knew that things were going to continue on, and the continuum would be there, which was very important.
One added feature is I have never seen patients as grateful as those patients. And so many times I'd find out that the patient I was seeing in the clinic had hiked for 30 miles to come to the clinic. And of course, they got there the day before, and they were in line, you know, the clinic closed before we could take care of everybody. So they lay on the ground and waited until the next day, and you know, our patients grumble if they wait 15 minutes.
A couple of things I would like to say before we go on to the Afghan refugees. The public health outpouring in Zimbabwe is fantastic. They have public health nurses who go out to all the districts. They have immunizations, well child care, family planning. The family planner worker is a woman who goes in to Harare for a 3-month training, and then they give her a bicycle, a uniform, and her portfolio, which is like a knapsack full of pills. The women come to the well child clinic. They have their little quarters tied up in the corner of their handkerchief, just like we used to tie up our quarters to go to Sunday school. And it's very, very important to them, because they know, because of the drought and because of the amount of food that they can grow, that they have to limit the size of their families. The other things that were important about Zimbabwe were, we did have malaria there, and we had cerebral malaria, which is the most vicious infection that we have ever seen. And they also had things like tuberculosis, they had tetanus, they had things that we hadn't seen since early 40s. So it was, that part of it was a little concerning.
The other feature is we saw a lot of really sick kids with infections, and they all got well. You know, practically, the rate of improvement was far better than the United States. And the reason was that the bugs were not resistant. You could treat the bugs.
You could use penicillin still.
Okay, now we move to Peshawar, Pakistan. And in this setting, we went to teach young men who had had no training in medicine whatsoever. They were in a medic program to learn to be primary care people, like barefoot doctors, in villages all through Afghanistan. Now, you have to remember that the war with Russia had been going on for a number of years, and the Russians had purposely knocked out all their irrigation systems. They had wiped out their education systems. They had wiped out and destroyed all their clinics in all the villages. All this designed to bring about, you know, bad morale, and they could, you know, easily conquer the country. They maintained the hospital in two major cities, Kabul and Jalalabad. And they staffed, since they had run out or killed or imprisoned all the doctors, they staffed it with their own doctors. So they kept on turning out physicians, but they were hideously poorly trained. So they were not much use and they were lying around, you know, in refugee camps, not being utilized at all. Now, the war had caused quite a few millions of refugees out of the country and into Pakistan, and into the Peshawar area, which is right at the other side of the Khyber Pass, where we were. The city of Peshawar normally is a 500,000 people population. It had almost 3 million refugees added to that. So if you talk about a teeming city, it was amazing. And most of them didn't live actually in the city. They lived in the perimeter in refugee camps that were made of just mud huts and walls. Everything in the Muslim world that has any women in it has to have a wall around it so that men can't see the women. And when the women go out, of course, they have to be covered from head to foot with a burqa or chadar. Now, the area where we were was rather bleak, as you can see here. This is a stream in the springtime, but the rest of the time is dry, wash, and the roads, of course, wash out, and I never rebuilt. So it's a rough ride to get out the 7 miles to our refugee camp where we work and our medical compound. This is the entrance, and there were guards and barbed wire on top of the walls and so on. And I kind of like this picture. A rose in the barrel.
Now, these two men both have been what we call freedom fighters in the war, and their mujahideen was the name that goes with it. And the hat is called a chitral hat. And you'll find any of the mujahideen, and it's still, if you see pictures in the paper of what's going on with the Taliban, who is the governing group in Afghanistan at this point, they're still wearing the chitral hat, and they're still mujahideen. We did have a little beauty in our life.
These are some of the staff, and this is the door that they had opened to let the patients flock in. And we would get, they'd allow a certain number, 100 or so, in, and then we would have a group that would go around and do what we call triage, and then investigate each one and see which ones were sick enough to require proper care. If they just had a minor skin infection, we'd give them a cake of soap and tell them to go home. If they had diarrhea, we'd get a sample, and if they had a treatable something, we'd just go ahead and treat them and not see them. This is outside the gate. Some of the young teenagers that lived across the street. And if you go out, you get engulfed. This is Lola, believe it or not, and the outfit that she had to wear.
Well, that's not my regular outfit. That was before I had my shalwar kameez, which I have to dress as the people there do. And I never could go without a headscarf.
Just some little children. They always gather to go out. And here's a whole bunch.
There's a lot of children. There's no family planning in this country.
In the morning, we'd see women and children. In the afternoon, we'd see men and children. But you could not mix them. These are the men. And our students were called medic students. And after 8 months of training, they would go into the back to their village, and they would be supplied with a couple of mule packs of supplies, and would be supervised by itinerant physician that would go around to check on how each one was doing, and all arranged by the outfit that we worked for, which is International Medical Corps, a private volunteer organization based in Los Angeles. This is the women's clinic. And this building over here was both examination rooms and the pharmacy. They get educated while they're waiting. There's an education process and help. We had a very high rate of malnutrition here. They were fed by food being given by volunteer organizations, but they gave it per family. And some of the families had 3 or 4 people in the family, others have 18 in the family. Mm-hmm. Got the same amount for each. Now we've got a whole bunch of pictures of children and so on. This is in the emergency room where we did suturing and things like that. This man with the mustache is one of the physicians that I evaluated to see if we would hire him, and he was a disaster. Infections of the skin were very rampant here as well, and he's got his feet soaking in permanganate. And you can see that this was taken to show the henna that they put on the hands and feet, and sometimes the hair.
These were two of our regulars, we called them. These two little girls would show up at triage at least 4 times a week. Mm-hmm. They just loved to come to visit. They were absolutely beautiful. Do any of you remember the picture on the front of the National Geographic of that absolutely stunning young woman with the green eyes? It was a few years ago. It was the most beautiful picture. Well, she was an Afghan refugee girl, and a lot of these girls had green eyes, as opposed to this man who has none.
He was, he got caught in the gas grenade, and that's just scar tissue all over his eyes.
Are you able to help a man like that?
Could not. The Russians dropped thousands and millions of mines, many of them in the shape of toys and butterflies and things like that, so that the children would pick them up and then get their eyes blinded and their hands blown off.
Now there's a group of people in this part of the world called the Kuchi people, who were some of the original nomads, and they would go from Western Afghanistan and Iran over through in India. And they traveled by camel, and they did this. They've done this for centuries. Well, the Afghan war absolutely interrupted their travels. And this little girl is a Kuchi girl, and you can tell the Kuchis by all the clothing that they wear, and that all of the beads and things, and she was a real charmer.
You notice there's a nose stud in there.
Oh, yeah.
This little boy was severely malnourished. And you can see the henna on the hair in this one.
What's henna?
Henna is a dye.
Just for beauty?
Yes.
Okay. Now, Lola took a lot of pictures. She called it her hat collection.
You'll have to just put up with my hat collection. I was so intrigued with these hats. They're absolutely, you know, in any culture that I've been in, you find that the people really love their children. I have not yet been in a culture where they don't. And the thing that they do here is they sew these wonderful, wonderful hats for the children. These people have nothing, literally nothing. This father brought this child in. Look at that. I just love this picture. Mm-hmm. And he's got a pole around the eyes to make sure about the whole kid infection. They also do these little vests. There's another one. I'm sorry, you have to put my hat for it. I went to Pakistan and learned how to run a computer. Now that was the last thing in the world that I expected to do. But this was 1989, and I was just starting on computers, and had just really kind of gotten the basics. And so I went over, and what we ended up doing was having to rewrite the medic manual. So I spent a lot of time on the computer. And I worked a lot with these two guys. Both of them were translators. Now the thing that they were doing is we had two translators who would translate from English to Farsi, which is the language there. And these two gentlemen would type in on the computers in Farsi. And then it would come out on the screen in this beautiful, beautiful Arabic language, this Farsi. And it would take a long time, and I looked one day to see where this Farsi program came from. Salt Lake City.
This is a volleyball game with the medics and the staff.
They're vicious volleyball players. I think this, I can't remember who won that one. This was our medic class. That, isn't that correct? I just stopped thinking.
Yeah.
That we graduated that year. And two of the young men in this class were so bright. It was just, they were so intelligent. It was just such a shame that they couldn't have just been plucked out and sent to medical school.
On the lower from the left.
Was incredible.
He would make the most wonderful decision. I've never seen a person so compassionate and bright at the same time.
And the second one from the right, he was the class clown. However, he was also had been a very good gunner with an anti-aircraft gun in Afghanistan during the war and had brought down three Russian planes. So he kind of coasted on that, but they really had to shape him up to get him to graduate.
This is the graduation meal. Matter of fact,
we left.
By the time we got to go through line, there wasn't anything left.
Like locusts.
Oh, yeah.
And for the eaters. This is interesting because this is the examination they take to be able to qualify to enter the program for the next session. And it's come from all different parts of Afghanistan with different heritage. You can see this Mongol-looking fellow here.
Now you have to remember this was 1989-1990 and there was no work for these men otherwise. There was nothing for them, there was no work at all. So for them to be able to come and take this program provided them employment and a salary, which they wouldn't have had otherwise.
Now this is the dining hall where we ate in the, a rather nice building. And the cook, we had two Afghan cooks who would slant their menu towards American food, fortunately for me.
And those are the best oranges you've ever had.
These are kinu. They're sort of, they're size of oranges, but they're peeled like a tangerine and are sweeter than either.
The people we worked with mostly in Peshawar were a lot of young physicians who had just finished their training and were ready to go on to do some more residency work. Phil and I were the seniors. We were the older couple outside of our director down here in the corner, who was a surgeon. So it was an interesting group to work with, all paid for 6-month periods.
The man at the head of the table is only there for 2 weeks. He's an orthopedic surgeon who came over, and they had everything all lined up. So he just did nothing but operate. Mm-hmm. This is one of our cooks on a picnic.
It's the other thing they love to do is go on picnics.
This is the son of our one of our Afghan physicians. And this is looking across the river from Akis, an irrigation into the refugee camp. And they bathe and wash and get their water from there, everything. There's usually one or two kids drown in there every year, which is really too bad. And they have two kinds of taxis. These are little motor scooters that they've got the tricycle.
Look like golf carts.
They
look like golf carts. And they're louder than golf carts, obviously. And they go like crazy. And they can turn in the length of themselves, and so they whisk around in the traffic. It's just hair raising. And this is the other taxi, the other form. And they have, they're quite beautiful. You can see the shiny sides, and they have little vases that sit on the fenders with a flower in them. Now, they like to decorate everything. This is a truck. Just a normal truck, not special.
Wow.
Some of them said Boeing on the front.
And this is a sheep bazaar. And we went here because Lola had brought her spinning wheel and she wanted a fleece to use. Mm-hmm. We couldn't find a fleece. We finally, they said, we won't shear the sheep because then it'll look skinny and it won't be worth as much.
So we bought the sheep and left the sheep and took the fleece. They made out on us just fine. They use a lot of child labor in Pakistan, Afghanistan. Children don't necessarily go to school. And this is, of course, the brass factory. This was a Pakistani family.
Now, we had a worship group that met every Friday. Friday is their holy day. It was about as ecumenical as you get. There were 26 countries, people from 26 countries involved, from all the British Isles, every place in Europe, Australia, Africa, every place. And on the way to worship.
One of the big things in this part of the world are the bazaars, and there was very little opportunity for us to get any exercise anywhere because women could not walk really outside of the compound. But we could go to the bazaars, and so we spent quite a bit of time walking in the bazaars. This tends to be this is the gold bazaar, and if any of you who have traveled in these kinds of countries, you know what fun bazaars can be. But this whole street is all gold merchants.
You see how narrow it is, and here's a donkey with a pack in the back, right in the back. And it's just like it was, you know, 2,000 years ago. Yeah. More of the same. Then I went to a camel bazaar, hoping I'd ride one. But these camels were feisty, and there was I call this one, and you think God doesn't have a sense of humor?
We also went to the gun bazaar. This was out in a place that's called Dara is the name of the town, but this is called no man's land. Essentially, there is no government here, and anything goes. And they sell hashish, they sell opium, and they sell guns. And they can make any kind of gun you would like. Whatever you want, they can whip it up. They have been doing this for centuries, and they are continuing to do this.
You won't believe it, but each one of these doorways is a separate little machine shop. And in its high quarters, they can turn on all this stuff. And, food bazaar.
They don't have supermarkets, remember, they have to go to the bazaar.
And this is a camel caravan.
In the middle of Peshawar, you would see a camel caravan and a water buffalo caravan. You just see everything wandering through. There's a movie called The Man Who Would Be King. It opens, the opening scenes are Peshawar, Pakistan. There's also the carpet bazaar, and we're not going to talk too much about that because Phil spent all of his time at the carpet bazaar. They do have beautiful, beautiful carpets, and the Afghans are known for that. And they wash them in the irrigation ditch. And that's bucephalus. They also have rosewood, which they make into furniture, and this came home with us.
Yeah?
Yeah.
This is wonderful. This is not finished yet. The mane, tail, and harness, no, no.
Bucephalus was the horse of Alexander the Great.
This is the furniture factory, a wooden floor, and this is the only machine tool that they had. Everything else is by hand. And the antiquities were incredible. This is a Buddhist temple, 3,000 years old.
Peshawar sat at a crossroads. Everything came through Peshawar, from Alexander the Great to Buddhism, and this is a huge Buddhist colony that's had something like 5,000 monks in it at one time. Quite beautiful. You can look, see how big it is.
Now this is another place. This is a tell. And this is that used to be the capital of the whole empire, from India all the way across what's now Pakistan and Afghanistan. This was called Pushkalabadi. And this is a urn that was underground but has now eroded to the point where you could see in the interior. And this is the national game of Pushkazim. It's sort of like polo, except they use no mallet, no ball. The object is a goat, which has had the head cut off, and that's sort of like the puck in hockey. Mm-hmm. And they carry it and try to, they circle around a pylon on one end of the field, and they have to drop it in a circle on the other. And they rip it away from each other, and it often lands on the ground, and when one person is reaching over to try to get it, they rear their horse up and whack at them with the horse's feet. So there's usually quite a bit of wounds, and there was only one person killed in this one.
Oh, wow.
This is a typical dinner.
The oldest son in the family serves, and of course the men and women eat separately. There was exceptions made for those of the American women, and we were able to eat with the men. We went to one dinner, and I was the only woman there.
This mountain sort of looks like Mount Shuksan, but it's three times the height. This is way up.
Again, another little piece of culture. These women are part of what's known as the Kalash, and the Kalash they're way up in a valley, up by northern Pakistan, where almost it goes into China. Thought to be descendants of Alexander the Great. They have blue eyes. They are not Muslim. They're animists. They have special rites and rituals that they abide by. And we were able to go up and visit them. So that was a real thing for me. I was interested in them.
The terrace there, field, as you can see.
This is our worship group, and the only thing I could think of, because I did not feel that this was the safest place in the world to be, and I walked in there and I said to these young women who were there with all these little children, "Did your mother approve of you being here?" There were times in Pakistan that we were not safe. In fact, our clinic was invaded, and it was rather interesting. Now, we're not going to have time to talk about anybody who's interested in going to work overseas, because we're going to have a staff meeting. But if any of you are interested in talking more about us, we're around till Saturday at 10:45, so we would be very happy to share any more information with you. Working overseas can be very exciting. There's a lot of things that you have to take into consideration. In fact, I've got a checklist of what you need to think about before you go. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now you guys all have to go because we have a staff meeting before Vespers.
What are you going to do after? Just discuss.
No, we're going to do the.